Okay, on with KUOW's The Record. Washington State is suing our president yet again. The Trump administration has issued new rules that let insurers and employers opt out of covering contraceptives in their health insurance plans. Yesterday, Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson challenged those rules in federal court. Attorney General Ferguson, welcome back to KUOW.
Thanks for having me on, Bill. Really appreciate it.
First, will you simply explain what the Trump administration is doing here?
Sure. What the Trump administration is doing is quite breathtaking. I mean, essentially what they're saying is that employers, if they have a religious or even a moral opposition to female employees using contraception or having contraception covered as part of their health care, can deny that as part of their health care coverage. We don't think that is defensible under our Constitution or even federal statutes, and that's why we brought a lawsuit.
Why unconstitutional? Why illegal? What's the case?
Sure. So your listeners should think of our lawsuits sort of two buckets. One, we have constitutional claims. So, for example, under our U.S. Constitution, this violates our sort of basic constitutional provisions, First Amendment, Fifth Amendment. To give you one example, that the rules, in our view, violate what we call the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment by requiring individuals, in this case women, to bear the burdens of religions to which they do not belong. So, for example, the rules permit a for-profit business to impose the costs of the owner's anti-contraception beliefs onto employees who may not share those beliefs, and that's not okay under our Constitution. We also have a separate area of claims that are under violations of federal statutes. These can get a little bit wonky. I won't go into details, but these things are important. The Administrative Procedure Act is a federal law. We've been beating Trump in court because he refuses to follow the requirements of this Administrative Procedure Act. Time and time again, we have a claim along those lines. Those are statutory claims as well.
What about the freedom of, let's say, a Catholic diocese or charity to not pay for something they are set up to oppose in line with their religious beliefs?
Yeah, so I mean, this is the right. There's a tension, right, in our society of how far does one's religious beliefs go, and when those religious beliefs adversely impact somebody else, right? And that's where courts grapple with this. I'm Catholic. I'm free to believe what I want to believe in my home, at our church here in Seattle with my family. But the law is clear that those religious beliefs, there's a point in which you are now impacting, in this case, your employees who are women. And this law, make no mistake, these rules target women specifically. It's not targeting men, that we feel it's also gender discrimination and violates our civil rights laws as well. So there are multiple claims. Courts take each case on its facts. But here we're talking about just businesses out there where an owner may have a moral opposition to contraception. That's not sufficient to pass constitutional scrutiny.
How many Washington State women do you estimate would lose the coverage of contraception in their health plans?
It's hard, Bill, to estimate that because it depends, of course, on how many business owners, you know, decide to utilize this new freedom they would have under these rules. But obviously the potential is there for many, many thousands of women to now have to bear the burden of, on their own, paying for their cost of contraception, which, as your listeners well know, can be quite expensive. So there'd be a significant cost to women in our state if this is allowed to go forward.
Attorney General Ferguson, there are legal organizations and unions suing over this. Why do we need our state attorney general to sue?
My feeling is that the people of the state of Washington deserve to have their attorney, the attorney general, standing up for them when the president takes an action that's going to have such a significant impact on many people in our state. So I'm someone who believes that as the attorney for the people, I have a role to play in these courts. I trust my legal team. We've had tremendous success suing the Trump administration. We've yet to lose a case. And I think the people want and frankly expect their attorney general to stand up to anyone, especially a president, if they're not following the Constitution and that those rules adversely impact the people of my state.
Yes, you sure are suing the Trump administration. Transgender military ban, DACA program for childhood arrivals, safety requirements for factories, student loan protections, energy efficiency requirements, Obamacare funding, coal leasing on public lands. Is it 15, 16 lawsuits now?
I think the latest count is 19 at this point.
19?
Yeah.
What are you not doing because you're so busy suing President Trump?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. You know, the AG's office is the largest law firm in the state of Washington. We have 600 attorneys, 600 professional staff who work every day on behalf of our state clients, boards, agencies, you name it. So that work goes on. I recognize that these cases tend to be in the headlines, but that doesn't change the fact that we can do more than one thing at a time. We're a big operation. That said, I do think that this administration is exceeding the bounds of their constitutional authority. Look, I twice sued the Obama administration when I thought they exceeded those bounds and harmed Washingtonians. So the Trump administration is going to insist on breaking the law. And again, Bill, we've yet to lose. Four of those 19 cases have been resolved by the courts. We won all four of them. And I think that's a testament to the fact that the administration refuses to follow the rules on these really important issues, which you just listed.
Well, as you've said, Attorney General, Washington state resources are scarce. Our state Supreme Court had to act to get the legislature to fund education. That's still a matter of controversy. Why is this a good use of limited Washington state taxpayer dollars?
Well, the good news for your listeners and for you to know is that the civil rights team in my office, which does the bulk of this work, there are no taxpayer dollars that fund that operation. That operation is funded entirely through recoveries we get through consumer protection actions. That's how I created the Civil Rights Unit. It did not exist before I was Attorney General. But I felt when I became Attorney General that, hey, we're the largest law firm in the state. We should be doing civil rights work on behalf of the people of the state. So I created that unit. Those individuals, again, no taxpayer dollars whatsoever pay for that. No taxpayer dollars for any of our consumer protection folks who work there as well. So there are no tax dollars for the overwhelming majority of the work that we're doing on these cases. That said, even if there were taxpayer dollars involved, I think it would be money well spent. But in this case, the Civil Rights Unit, not one dime of general fund support goes to that operation.
And finally, let's turn to gun regulation. Last year, you proposed a Washington state ban on semi-automatic rifles and high-capacity magazines, and that was before the Las Vegas shooter showed us what damage you can do with a semi-automatic. Mm-hmm. Will you do anything differently now?
Well, we're going to bring those proposals back again. I'm going to keep bringing them back until the legislature, frankly, members of both parties confront this issue and take a vote. We could not even get votes in committees, both in the Democratic House or the Republican-controlled Senate, on those issues. Look, there is no limit to a high-capacity magazine in our state. Not at all. You can have a high-capacity magazine as you want in this state. That's not okay from my standpoint. So I'm going to keep proposing these bills until, frankly, the legislators and both parties face this issue head-on and take what's going to be a tough vote for them.
Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson is joining some other states and organizations in suing the Trump administration over new rules that let insurers and employers opt out of covering contraceptives in their health insurance plans. Lawsuit number 19 against the Trump administration. Attorney General Bob Ferguson, thanks for this time.
You bet, Bill. Have a great day.
Same to you. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. How not to be one of those rescued hikers, and what does a lack of salmon say about the Puget Sound and local culture, tribes? All that's coming up on The Record, so stick around. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Did you read about the hiker who got rescued from Yakima's Goat Rock Wilderness over the weekend? A search and rescue crew found the man a day earlier. Both the hiker and the rescuers had to spend a cold, wet night on an exposed ridge until the helicopter could land the next day. Get this, until the helicopter could land with its front tires on the trail and back tires still in the air. Does a helicopter have tires? I guess it does. I imagine they were runners. But anyway, the helicopter's poised partly on the trail while it's helping this person. Now, on KOW, we do not want you to be that rescued hiker. With me now to help is Taylor Brew with Seattle Mountain Rescue and Sandeep Nan, owner of MeR Adventures, and he's volunteered with the Everett Mountain Rescue. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, let's help. In fact, you listening might help, too. Your hiking mistake, that's somebody else's hiking lesson. So, we are at 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. Tell us about a time you were caught unprepared, what went wrong, what you learned, what you shan't ever do again. 206-543-5869. First, Sandeep, you've had your own experience with mountain rescue. What happened to you?
For my rescue or?
I don't know. I heard that there was maybe a friend of yours who fell. What was your brush with mountain rescue?
Yes, so that was my friend Myers McDonough. We used to be roommates and climbing buddies and part of Everett Mountain Rescue together. And so he was on a climb of West Ridge of Stewart with a friend, another fellow mountain rescue person, and Matt. And so when they were climbing up, it's a lot of route finding and a little bit of loose rock here and there. And because it's not very hard climbing, you don't put a lot of protection everywhere. Anyway, so to keep it short, he took a fall and took a bad tumble, and the last piece was a little bit far behind. He had serious concussion and got badly injured on his shoulder, and his climbing partner couldn't get to him because he fell a little bit far away, and with the amount of rope and all that. And so they talked, and he wasn't responding properly, so they didn't have any way to communicate, no PRB, any kind of personal locating beacon or satellite messenger or anything. So they, his partner Matt, decided to come down, which is very, very hard to go down on a climbing route on your own, mm-hmm. especially when you have to leave the rope there. It's almost impossible, but that was the best decision that time to save, you know, to help with Miles' rescue and save his life. And so he came back and finally managed to get a signal when he was down there. And so he called.
A cell phone signal?
Cell phone signal, uh-huh. Yes. So we got, because we were part of the mountain rescue, I got a page or a message on my phone. And so we all, of course, you know, it's Myers and our friend. And so we all went there immediately to the meeting place at Everett. They had already sent a helicopter by that time, because it's very high, around 9,000 feet where it happened, and the weather wasn't good. It was very windy, so the helicopter couldn't really get close to him. But they did see him maybe lying down on the snow, unconscious. So that was very bad news for us. So we wanted to go and start a rescue because we don't know if next day same thing may happen that we can't get to him.
Right.
So I really wanted to go and get something, maybe at least take it, because they were doing it as a day trip, fast and light and fast. So didn't really have sleeping bag or any of those other emergency BV items. So I wanted to go up there. But they were very reluctant, of course, for good reason, because it's a steep mountain. It's already night, going up on a steep mountain in the night. I had thankfully been there just two or three times that season itself before that and came down on that path. So I was very familiar with it. So two other climbing buddies and mountain rescue member, Kevin and Jonah, and three of us kind of made a team to go unofficially to start the rescue. And both of them were EMT. So we carried a lot of stuff with us, like sleeping bag, mat, first aid kits, stove, food.
Was he still unconscious when you got to him?
We got there. So 2 a.m. is when we started walking up on the trail. And by, I think, 7, 8 a.m., we were up at the top. And then we had to do rappel down to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, by that time, conscious, actually.
Okay.
And he was, so we...
What can we learn from that, Sandeep?
I would say the biggest lesson is carrying, especially on big mountains like that, Stuart, and anytime you're going deeper in the wilderness, having a PLB is like life-saving.
What's a PLB?
It's like a personal locating beacon.
A beacon, yeah. Beams your location.
Yeah, beams your location. And there are multiple out there, you know, that each have their pros and cons.
Mm-hmm.
But that could have made it start like much earlier. It happened the day before at noon, and thankfully he survived the night. But, you know, it would have all started much earlier. Maybe the helicopter could have reached him earlier. We could have started a in-ground rescue much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
If it was that. Okay. The second, in my opinion, would be just to add on that, even if we all want to, as a climbers, want to go light and fast, but having some kind of emergency BV and sleeping bag, or between a team of two or three people, especially when tackling a big peak like that.
It might not be a day trip after all,
it turns out.
Bring a sleeping bag.
It happens again and again on Stuart. So many times people think it would be a day trip, and they end up staying for overnight on Stuart.
Okay, stuff in a bag, personal locator beacon. Taylor, you've been climbing since you were 10. Have you had something go really wrong? You got a story?
I don't know if I have a good story like that. I mean, I've had a lot of different experiences in the mountains, and I've been pretty fortunate in that I've never actually been rescued. And I've, you know, I've had some late nights where I kind of come out to the trailhead at 4 or 5 a.m. the next day, but it's never been to the extreme where I had to call for a rescue.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, Sandeep's point about having some form of communication is huge.
Yeah.
I think that Matt, who was Miles' climbing partner, is a friend of mine. And when I climb with Matt, he always carries a PLB regardless of where we're going.
What's the cost of a PLB? How much does it cost? And is it heavy? Is it taking up space in your pack? Otherwise, anybody would clip that thing on their belt or something.
Yeah, so I mean, it there's lots of different manufacturers of PLBs, and you know, they have different functionality. There's the Spot, there's the DeLorme, there's different varieties. Uh-huh. And, you know, go to REI and you can figure out what's the best for you. Some of them, you know, can communicate two ways, where some are just sending an emergency signal to the military to get a rescue in place. And you know, they're pretty lightweight. They're no more than, you know, probably 6 or 8 ounces.
Oh.
And they're about the size of, you know, small first aid kit.
So. Okay. When we're taking your call, listener, your hiking mistake is somebody else's valuable lesson. So 206-543-5869. What did you do wrong? What did you learn? 543-5869. And we have a call from a KUOW listener, Christy Weber. Christy, you ran into some trouble hiking the Wonderland Trail around Mount Rainier?
I did. Yes.
Thanks for joining us. What happened?
Well, we were on, so we had planned for a 9 to 10 day trip, and we were on day 3, and I was pounding my way down the trail into Carbon River, and I heard a loud snap and chose to ignore it and kept walking, and it turns out I actually had broken my foot.
You ignored that?
I did. Wow. I had spent a year planning this trip. It was kind of my baby. So I did not want anything to throw it off, but I got down to the campsite and actually made the mistake of taking my shoe and my sock off, and my foot immediately swelled to maybe 3 sizes.
A sock keeps a foot that wants to swell from swelling?
Well, I had a shoe on, so yeah. I mean, I don't think anything would have stopped it, but I wasn't going. I mean, after doing that, it was very clear I was not going anywhere on that foot. And I had 3 other women with me, and what we ended up doing, I think it was about 36 hours until 2 rangers showed up. And what we ended up doing is the next morning, 2 of the women hiked up to the next basically ranger cabin, and they tried to tell anybody they ran into what the situation was with little guarantee. I mean, these were other folks hiking the Wonderland, not sure where rangers were, who they were going to run into. And it just turned out that about 36 hours later, while we were having dinner and trying to determine, you know, what our next step was going to be, these 2 rangers come walking into our camp. And they didn't know my age. They didn't know how badly I was hurt. I mean, we had kind of failed to provide them probably with some information that would have been very helpful to them. But they brought crutches with them, and they gave me the choice and said, we can either crutch out until we meet the litter cart. I don't know if you're familiar with what a litter cart is, but it's a stretcher that basically is on one wheel in the middle. So you lay on it, and then there's 4 rangers that wheel you on the trail, basically.
Right, I can picture that.
Yeah, so I said, give me the crutches, and I crutched, I don't even know how long it was. It was a long time across the boulder field of that area of Rainier, and then somewhere in the middle of the night, we met the other rangers who had brought the litter cart in, and they put me on the litter cart for the rest of the way to the Carbon River road that's now closed, where they were able to have ATVs that took me out. So
Christy, on top of everything you were dealing with, I don't think it's fair that you had to be called a litter cart, what you were being pulled around in. But what was the lesson you learned?
Sure. Well, it sounds funny, but I always carry painkillers with me now. Mm-hmm. You know, we were not in a situation, we had planned for a 9-day backpack trip, so we had lots of food, lots of gear. It was more of a question of how long do you stay at a campsite. We had everything we would have needed. However, we were contemplating, how do we get me off the mountain? Mm-hmm. And one of the ways, I was going to try to hike out of there. And so one thing I do is I definitely carry painkillers with me. I think that would have helped in any situation. We did have a spot tracker. So that was an option available to us. So a spot tracker is similar to what the other folks were talking about, where it's a beacon, mm-hmm. and I could have pushed the emergency button and had rescue know where we were. But it was one of those situations where it wasn't life-threatening, and so it was, you know, a continued discussion of, you know, when do you use such a device. Mm-hmm. And folks at home were following us, so they could see that for the last 36 hours, we hadn't moved on the trail. So everyone knew there was something wrong. The second thing is, you know, I'm an avid hiker, avid backpacker, but I took the same attitude before this that I think a lot of people do, that it's just going to be, I can go on a day hike and I'll be fine. I'll take some water. I'll take some food. And after that experience on a trail that can be pretty heavily populated and with all the gear, I don't go for a day hike without 10 essentials. I don't hike by myself anymore, actually. I think there are people that would be comfortable with that. But I think given my experience, having three other people there to help out was important to me. So I don't hike alone anymore. And I think, you know, having the attitude now that anything can go wrong. Obviously, I didn't on day three anticipate, I mean, I almost needed surgery. That's how badly I broke my foot. Mm-hmm. I didn't anticipate that happening to me. So I think having a mindset that things can go wrong and it can be perfect weather. I mean, everything can be perfect conditions. And all it takes is one thing to happen and you're stuck on a mountain with potentially no one there to help you.
Christy Weber, I'm glad you're not still on the Wonderland Trail around Mount Rainier. Thank you so much for telling us your story and your lessons.
Yes. Thank you so much.
So some good advice so far. The beacon, the sleeping bag, the painkillers, the don't be alone, and we'll get to the 10 essentials. We're taking another call from Maverick in Seattle. Maverick, what's your story?
Well, good afternoon, Bill. I learned the true meaning of terror. I was hiking on the Robe River Trail out by Verlot, catching some trout, having a good time. Stayed a little bit past sunset, and that was a big mistake. When I tried to walk out, I walked up actually past the trail, wound up in a kind of a tree fall, and wound up losing my footing on some false ground. I fell about maybe 60 to 80 feet, kind of hard to estimate, but it took a long time. When I finally came to rest, I was wedged in between a couple of tree branches, with two twisted knees, two twisted ankles, two twisted elbows, and one twisted wrist. The 25-minute hike that it takes to get in there took me nearly 4 hours to get out because it was so dark. The only way I could make any progress was I had a lighter, and I found a little white label that was on my backpack, which I tore off and put in the palm of my hand, and I would flash the lighter using the white label as a reflector, and then I could see far enough ahead to take 8 steps at a time.
Okay, so I'm hearing flashlight / headlamp is another lesson to add to our list, Maverick.
Yeah, and maybe a bottle of bourbon in case you have to spend the night.
And a bottle of bourbon. Maverick, thank you. Glad you're here.
All right, bye-bye.
We're helping you not be that rescued hiker, and I'm talking with my guests in the studio, Taylor Brew and Sandeep Nan. Christy mentioned the 10 essentials. What are the 10 essentials? You have them memorized, or should you just Google 10 essentials?
I guess Google 10 essentials.
Okay. Did you learn anything? Any advice based on what you heard?
I thought one key point that that the first caller mentioned, Christy, was that she was hesitant to call for a rescue. And I just would like to mention that, you know, in King County, Seattle Mountain Rescue is an all-volunteer organization. And so if you call for a rescue in King County, you're not going to get a bill for it. And I just want to mention that because I think that that's sometimes a deterrent for people. They're very hesitant to call for a rescue. And they'll wait until night falls, until, you know, the storm hits, and they'll be in a worse condition than if they would have called earlier on. So, I mean, there's a multitude of reasons not to call for a rescue, but
pride,
everything you can think.
Don't want to be a bother.
Exactly. But
call.
Just be aware that situations can get worse. They can escalate quickly, and it doesn't hurt.
What advice do you want to give, Sandeep?
Carry 10 essentials. Mm-hmm. Will be for the especially the second person who called. Like having a headlamp and bottle of bourbon may give comfort for temporarily, but it's not really going to help you with the cold.
That would be 11 essentials. So let's leave the bourbon aside for a moment.
But I'm saying if you like having, again, that sleeping bag or extra clothing, extra food, you know, something to keep you warm, emergency BV, emergency blanket, a lot of these things are very light these days, and we can carry them always with us. Some kind of first aid kit and, you know, so I may be missing some of the essentials, but that and one very essential part is, because not everyone is going to just go and buy PRB.
That's again the beacon, the personal locator beacon,
which could be Spot or Dell'Rom or any of those, or it could be a satellite phone, or you know, because they are a little bit pricey. I think they are worth the money though, $300, $400, $500. You know, so they vary, but if they can be life savior, and it can be so much comforting for your family members to know where you are, what you are doing. But on the
charge the family members, have them help pay for it. If it's so comforting to them.
It's not just comfort though, there is safety, right? But in any case, like even if you're going Tiger or Mount Si or any of these mountains close by, many times we don't, at the very least, leave a detailed plan with your family members and friends, where you are going, what is your plan, where your car will be parked. I mean, there are many templates available. I'm sure on Seattle Mountain Rescue, Everett Mountain Rescue, there is one, there is a template available. What time you are planning to come, where if you are camping overnight, where you will be camping, so everyone knows your plan, so that they can actually, if you got lost, even if you don't have a beacon, they can at least know where to look for you.
That's great advice. Final call from Kristen in Bellevue. Kristen, thanks for calling. What's your story?
Well, my story is actually rather embarrassing, but my husband, it was quite a while ago before there was cell coverage in the Cascades, as well as there is now. And my husband went off climbing with some friends on Johannesburg and told the wives they were going to be home by Sunday night. Didn't get out till midday Monday, and everything was fine. It just took longer. But because we wives with babies at home thought they were going to be home earlier, we all panicked. And unfortunately, I had some connections that enabled me to get a helicopter up in the air first thing Monday morning at daylight, which landed in the parking lot to check their cars as the boys were hiking out, quite chagrined. And to the last caller, I'll say we did end up reimbursing for the helicopter only because we could and we were embarrassed, but not because they asked us to. It's just really important for climbers to manage the expectations of the people back home. And if you think that you're studs and you're going to go out and you're going to do a hard climb and you're going to do it well and get out and everything's going to go fine, don't tell the people at home that that's what your timeline is, because we'll panic, and that's super important to not let happen.
Yes, good point, Kristen. Not that your husband's not a stud. No one's suggesting that, but yes, communicate what the plan is.
Don't say anything.
Yeah. Kristen in Bellevue, thanks for that. Any final words on how not to be a rescued hiker, how to get out there and get over the obstacles of, I mean, it's daunting to be, now in order to go out, I have to be perfectly prepared. I've got to have everything on this list and think of everything. That could just keep some people at home, Taylor.
You know, one thing that I'll mention is that I think that there's a lot of value in going out with somebody more experienced than yourself to learn from. I've had mentors throughout my climbing career, and while I've still made mistakes, when I'm out with them, I still feel like I can leverage their experience to make better decisions. So even if you're going to hike Mount Si, go with somebody who's done it before.
Someone who's more of a stud, if that's possible. Using Kristen's words, by the way, in case you just tuned in. Okay, lots of good advice for you. The beacon, the sleeping bag, the painkillers, don't be alone. A headlamp, please. Make a plan, a detailed plan. Don't wait to call rescue, and go with somebody who's better at it than you are, more experienced than you are. And you can Google the 10 essentials. We've been talking with Taylor Brew with Seattle Mountain Rescue and Sandeep Nan, owner of Miar Adventures, who's also volunteered with Everett Mountain Rescue. So they know what they're talking about. Guys, thanks a lot for this. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
More of KUOW's The Record coming up. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Our Northwest salmon seem to be disappearing. Scientists who count salmon off the Washington and Oregon coasts are, for the first time, hauling up empty nets. One scientist told the Seattle Times he wondered if there was something wrong with their equipment. What's going on, and why should you care about dwindling salmon? Here is Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes. So good to see you again, Linda. Thank you.
Good to see you, Bill.
First of all, what's happened to the salmon?
Well, this is really disturbing news. You know, it's not often you talk to scientists and they sound like this.
Right.
They go out and they do a routine survey they've been doing for 20 years and the results are so shocking. They think, God, is our net even working? Is there a big hole or something? And what did happen was they do a survey off the coast of Washington every year to check on the status of the juvenile salmon, the little guys, moving out that year.
You just made it out of fresh water and they're headed out.
Exactly. And so they were counting these fish from Nea Bay all the way down to midway down the Oregon coast. And what happened was they set out their trawl net and they pulled it once, they pulled it twice, they pulled it a third time, and there was absolutely nothing in it. And that was very alarming to them. And as they went further north, they started catching fish, but the wrong fish. Instead of catching the native salmon they were looking for from the Columbia River, they were catching warm water species, tropical species, fish that came here during the blob, that huge mass of superheated water in the ocean that came here, began forming off the coast of Washington and beyond in about 2013. A lot of species came into our waters that aren't normally here then, and the blob is gone, but those animals are still here. And
what does this say about the health of our waters?
Well, it's upside down, you know, this interconnected, beautiful system, everything connected to everything else. Right now, scientists are concerned they see some kind of profound shift underway, not just a blip in not so great ocean conditions. We're used to that in the Northwest. We talk about that. It happens. It comes. It goes. This is a little different. This seems to be a more wholesale shift where you have species out of place. You have food webs that are disrupted. You have little tiny things that the bigger things need to eat in very scarce supply, which means you have animals eating things they don't usually eat. And perhaps it's possible one of the reasons you're seeing so few juvenile salmon is because some of the birds that would normally be eating herring and other forage fish are turning to baby salmon because there's so few forage fish. Another thing that corroborates that theory is when they did surveys in the estuary, they didn't see the same sorts of problems. It seemed to be in the ocean. It was a shift in the ocean regime. And so this was so concerning to the scientists that they put together a memo and distributed it to managers at NOAA Fisheries, that's where these scientists work, really as an early warning, because in the ocean, as elsewhere in the environment, conditions today portend problems in the future. These are out-migrating juveniles, and if we have very few of them, of course, that means fewer returning adults in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very bad news in a system such as ours in the Pacific Northwest, where we have endangered orca whales that depend specifically on Chinook salmon and, in fact, salmon from the Columbia River to sustain themselves. And we already have orcas at a 30-year low in their population. And at least part of the problem they're facing is starvation.
Yeah. So this is about tribal sustenance. This is about orcas, a fishing industry, tourism, affordable salmon on your plate, right?
Even identity. We think
identity of
ourselves as a place of abundance. This is a place where people have lived for more than 10,000 years because it is a place of abundance. And there's something heartbreaking and profoundly disturbing when that abundance becomes scarcity.
Meanwhile, I'm wondering whether we're nearing the end of farm salmon raising in Puget Sound. You know, some farm salmon pens collapsed this summer near the San Juan, sending 100,000 non-native Atlantic fish into our waters. This week, I want to play you something, Linda. This week, Washington Lands Commissioner Hillary Franz told KUOW maybe it's time for these Atlantic fish to go.
I believe that it is not in our state's best interest to be having these non-native fish in the Puget Sound, especially given the threats that our own native species of salmon are facing already. I'm looking forward to a broad conversation with the critical stakeholders from our tribal communities to our state leaders about whether this is what we should be doing.
Is that big news for our lands commissioner to be saying that?
Absolutely. The lands commissioner holds the leases on public bedlands over which these farms operate. There are 8 of them in Puget Sound. And so for the leaseholder to say she's got grave doubts about even doing this certainly is news and important. And, you know, I think one of the things that I appreciate about this story, which people have been reading everywhere over and over. It's a story that people are really fascinated with. It's a useful story because it illuminates a lot. It illuminates, first of all, the fact that we even have this industry here, which, by the way, is not typical. Oregon has no open water Atlantic salmon aquaculture industry. California actually bans it, as does Alaska. So we're the only state that does this in the west coast of America.
British Columbia?
British Columbia is very heavily farmed. There are many, many fish farms there. There is actually an ongoing protest against those farms by some of the indigenous people who have actually occupied some of the farms, saying they refuse to leave until the BC government cancels the leases because of their concerns about pollution. And interestingly, now in our state, there's a very sustained cry from Native people as well as conservationists saying it's time for these farms to go. And state legislators are also looking at taking steps this legislative session to end this practice. Not all aquaculture. As you probably know, aquaculture is a very, very big business in Washington, everything from gooey ducks to clams. We're talking about something very specific here, which is open water Atlantic salmon net pen farming.
Meanwhile, let's talk about the great fish escape that happened in August, these 100,000 farmed Atlantic salmon entering the water. What was the concern and what has actually happened?
Well, this was a shock to a lot of people. So on a Saturday in August, suddenly one of these pens started to drift. And then by Sunday, it just plain blew apart. It just broke to pieces. And I heard about it because Lummi fishermen started calling me saying, hey, we're catching these Atlantic salmon in our nets. And it wasn't actually until Wednesday morning that Cook Aquaculture, which is a family-owned, privately held company based in New Brunswick, Canada, finally talked to the public about what had happened. They had told their regulators, but they hadn't made any public statements. And
What have we learned from the unwanted experiment? What's happened to these Atlantic fish?
Well, they've dispersed far and wide. They caught about half of the fish. They either caught them or they never got out of the nets. They were entangled. But the rest of them, about 105,000 of them, they got out. And we had reports from native fishermen and tribes, WDFW, and just ordinary people, of finding these fish here, there, everywhere. Everywhere from down here in Seattle to all the way up in BC. And I mean far and wide.
And are there terrible results? Are they interbreeding? There were so many concerns. What do we know?
I'll tell you something. I think the single most interesting quote that I've heard in the reporting of this story came from a scientist up in Canada who said to me, anyone who tells you that this either is or isn't a problem is speaking either from emotion or ideology, because there's just no science. He is the only invasion ecologist that I could find who had published some peer-reviewed papers on this topic. The research in this just hasn't been funded because who wants to know, right?
Yeah.
So that's a big part of the problem here. We don't really know what happens. This is one of the worst escapes ever in Washington State. There have been bigger ones. Now, interestingly, in the past, WDFW has actually stocked these things, trying to get something else out there for people to catch, yep. And they were unsuccessful. We've had bigger escapes. We have not yet seen Atlantic salmon make their home in our waters. However, across the border in Canada, breeding by Atlantic salmon has occurred, not with Pacific salmon, but they have been able to replicate themselves. Now, so far, no one is aware of a crossbreeding between the two species. But, David Montgomery at the University of Washington wrote an op-ed piece in our paper, and it was interesting. He talked about just increasing the odds. You know, the more of these things you throw at them and the more often you do it, something eventually catches hold. But the main point I want people to hear is that we have very little science on this. So anyone who says, whether it's Cook Aquaculture or anybody else, that they know for sure it either is or isn't a problem, show me what you base it on.
Yeah. Ideology or emotion. And that's not how Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes operates. Good to see you again. Thanks for catching us up on this.
Thank you.
Let's do it again. We want to know what's unfolding. This is KUOW's The Record, and we're going to be right back at you in just a moment.